It's so quiet in here, and people online, you're sitting so still. Maybe my instinct is to say hello, but maybe I shouldn't. Maybe that's saying too much, and I've already said too much, so. Nice to be here with you. It's very nice. Am I loud enough for you in here? And I trust that online you can just turn the volume up as you wish. So, the topic of the five faculties. Sometimes I think of them as faculties, as capacities we have, and they're capacities we can develop. In fact, in the tradition, there's the same list called the five powers. And in fact, the difference between different levels of maturity in the Dharma has to do with how strong these capacities have become. Have they become powers of their own? So I was thinking, I loved Andrea's beginning yesterday by starting with wisdom. Today I'll start with a traditional order with faith. And some of it was just listening to her delight and maybe her love for wisdom. And I was thinking about these five faculties. I think I love them all. Isn't that nice? It's kind of, you know, five faculties, another list. But I've come to really cherish them and love them, and so much so that the first one in Pali, it's Sada, Shraddha in Sanskrit. If I take a little bit of liberties with the word, I think I'd like to translate it as love. It's kind of the fuel for all the others. It's the one that probably most closely relates to inspiration, most closely relates to joy, that brings the joy and the inspiration into the practice. And so it's just delightful to have this sadha. Exactly what it is in English. Andrea talked about some different translations yesterday. There's a scholar of pre-Buddhist India who has studied the Rig Veda, the most ancient surviving literature from India, and said in that text, sadha means hospitality. That's pretty cool. Hospitality. So the love, the support that holds this practice, that fuels this practice as a form of hospitality, that kind of puts a whole different spin on what are we doing here? We're here to really to be the host for something. And what is it like to be a host? Usually hosts are not greedy. Like, what can I get out of this? It's more like, what can I give to my guest? How can I welcome my guest? And recently, a man who studies a lot of kind of non-Buddhist Indian religious texts came up to me and said, sadha, da part of sadha is the same da root as the word dharma, meaning support. And so it's what supports us, what buoys us, what inspires us in this practice. So that's, you know, if I take some liberties with the word, I think I would kind of like to translate the words with words like that, or associate them with words like that. And I'm using this word, taking liberties, purposefully, because when you translate Pali words, Indic words into English, It's hard to get to a one-to-one match. And so there's often different translators will choose different words. And sometimes the choice is confidence. And confidence works really well in a retreat setting. We're having confidence in the practice, confidence in the purpose of the practice, confidence in our ability to practice, confidence that this is the right time to be there doing the practice, is a part of the fuel, part of the support that keeps us engaged and, you know, and not becoming doubtful, not slowing down, not taking a break, or not kind of, you know, deciding, well, really what I should be doing is trying to calculate my taxes. And that would be this retreat with a lot of space, empty space, and figuring out my taxes. This is the time I have time, you know, or even better, maybe I should, this is the time, free time, lots of free time here. And I bet I can calculate lottery tickets, what the right number is going to be. So I'm being silly, of course, but, you know, we take all these detours. But when we're really rooted and supported and inspired by the confidence in what we're doing here, there's a kind of wholeheartedness that we can give. So some people like the word faith for this to translate sadha. And so what I want to say, I want to talk more about these different choices. But this is the part of the Dharma that you can personalize. And this is a very important part of Dharma practice, is to personalize it. Find how it applies to you and what is your version of it for this day, for this week, for this year, for this lifetime. What fits? What's a good fit for you that supports you? Some of you, coming from certain religious backgrounds or non-religious backgrounds, find the word faith very troublesome. Some of you find it very inspiring. Some of you find the word confidence is really reassuring. Some of you might find it kind of like uninspiring, like, you know, it doesn't really do much for you. So you get to kind of choose your own word so that you're supported by the concept. You don't have to just take the Dharma teacher's choice for how to translate these words. So there's, in a certain sense, there's a lot of freedom to personalize the Dharma in some areas. In other areas of the Dharma, you can't personalize it. If you're going to do Dharma practice, if you're going to do Buddhism, you have to kind of accept, okay, this is what it's about, and I can't really, you know, use my preferences to do something a little different or to twist it into something else or something. And so there's both parts. So I'll talk about both sides today. And so I started off here with the choice of the word. It's not just a linguistic thing, you know, that's kind of interesting, but rather it's really pointing to what is it really inspires you? What works for you so that on this retreat, you could offer your wholehearted attention, wholehearted efforts to really doing the practice and do it with a much continuity that you're inspired to do. Some people really like the word trust. There was a time in my life, a phase of my Dharma practice where the word trust really was important for me. And I upset one friend of mine a little bit because I talk so much about this trust, and she'd say, trust in what? I said, no, I don't have that. There's no what. I just trust. And that confused her. Maybe it confuses you too. But just this kind of feeling to say trust life is not quite right. And I didn't want to have a what. It's just a feeling, the sense that it was a capacity, it was a mood, it was an emotion, it was a state of trust that didn't need an object. I thought that was pretty special. have an object is kind of like extra. It's just to have this wonderful state. So this word faith and sada and confidence, they're states we have, and that's kind of the reference point for it. I like the word faith a lot. For me, that's has a more emotional content. I grew up a-religious and didn't really like religion, so it's a little surprise that I come around and like the word faith now. But I associate it more the emotional side of practice in a way that I don't quite get with confidence. Other people would get that in confidence, so it just, you know, it's, we each personalize it, right? And in that regard, I love some of the ways we use the word faith in English, and it's a kind of instructive. We use it sometimes like to keep the faith, means to keep the commitment, keep the belief, keep going with something that's really important to kind of stay close to and be loyal to. The word faith and fidelity has the same root, Latin root for faith, to have a fidelity to something. And, you know, so to a marriage, for example, keep the faith. You know, being faithless in a marriage has a very strong meaning. And some things we have a commitment to, we give ourselves over to. And to say, you know, I have confidence in the marriage, it doesn't really convey the same thing as I'm keeping the faith. I like the expression people of faith. Sometimes clergy are called people of faith, or as you use the word people of faith, maybe there's a different associations to that word. But for me, I think this is someone who is, there's a way in which they appear in the world or act in the world, which you have a higher expectations of someone who's going to be ethical. At least I do. If I hear that person, a man, a person of faith, I expect someone who's committed certainly to their faith and living by it, but I expect a kind of an attitude of how to be in the world that's dedicated to being loving and kind and supportive and ethical. That seems to be how the word sada was sometimes understood in the suttas in ancient India, that people who had sada, it seemed to didn't necessarily mean that they had faith in a particular religion of the time, or even a particular teacher back then, but they had a certain way of living that was inspiring. And I think for the Buddha, it was certainly would high expectation that would be an ethical way of living. There's something important to be that about some, there's some kind of inner capacity, inner way of being, a state almost, that when you have it, you're going to live ethically. You're going to live kindly. You're going to live with different set of values than greed, hate, and delusion. So faith, loyalty, commitment. And so we'll come back to this as we go through this little journey we're taking here. So there's a story that before the Buddha was enlightened, he went off to study with two meditation masters of his time. And he mastered not only the meditation they taught, but he mastered their teachings first. So he learned what they had to teach. And they said, well, this is not enough just to know their teaching. This hasn't helped me with the end of suffering. And he said, well, my teacher has sadha, faith, confidence. My teacher has energy, has mindfulness, has wisdom, has concentration and has wisdom. And the Buddha says, I have sadha. I have virya. I have sati. I have samadhi. I have panya. And he said, so I'm going to do the same practice he does. And he did it and he attained that level of meditation and he realized this wasn't quite it. Actually, the teacher said, great, you're just like me now. You can now teach for me. But no, this is not quite it. It doesn't answer my question. So he did that with two different meditation teachers. But this idea that Buddha said, I have faith. He wasn't having faith in the teacher. he wasn't having faith in Buddhism because it didn't exist yet. He hadn't, you know, he didn't know what it was yet. And but he had faith in, maybe you can say, confidence in himself. Maybe that was a good translation for that term, that he had confidence. He had something. But I kind of think that it wasn't just confidence in himself. He had a certain kind of confidence or trust or faith in another way of being, another set of values of how to be in the world. It was radically different from what he had left behind when he set forth to become awakened. So at one point in his life, he talks about what it was like when he practiced. So he left his teachers, and at some point he went to practice and meditate in the woods. He spent a lot of time practicing in the wilderness, apparently. And there, so after he was enlightened, some person came and said to the Buddha, "Hey, you Buddhists and your monks, they spend a lot of time practicing in the woods, in the wilderness, but that's really scary. You know, how do you guys manage? You know, it's frightening to be out there alone and at night meditating." And the Buddha said, "Oh yeah, it's frightening out there." So he would be alone out in the woods. And he says, "But when before I was enlightened and I considered going into the wilderness, I considered that, well, for people who are living an unethical life, for them, going into the woods, the wilderness, is scary. But I haven't been unethical, so it's not scary for me from that way. For people who have a lot of sensual desire, to go in the wilderness is frightening. But I don't have sensual desires. I don't think I have that source of fear. For people who have a lot of ill will, it can be scary to go into the wilderness. But I don't have any ill will. For people who have a lot of sloth and torpor, for people who have a lot of restlessness and regrets, people have a lot of doubt." So the five hindrances. For people, and he goes on, he says other things. For people who have, who are given to self-praise and disparagement of others, it can be frightening to go into the wilderness. You can imagine if you're caught up in these kinds of concerns, and that's what you're attached to, what happens in the wilderness? You can't get them, you think about them a lot, and maybe if you have a disposition, if you're subject to feeling terror, the wilderness is frightening. That kind of makes sense. And then, so you can say, of course, there's things like this. And then he says, "So I went into the wilderness, and I had fear." So it wasn't that the Buddha was not susceptible to fear, but he was prepared for it. And this idea that you don't go into the wilderness without preparing. You don't go into deep states of meditation without some preparation. And the wisdom of this is learn to practice with the hindrances. Learn to be honest about these things that are our foils and challenges. They're actually important things to love and care for. Your love is to really meet these kinds of challenges we have, to learn how to settle them enough so that they're not the triggers for our fear when we go into the wilderness of the heart, for example. So that takes a while, and sometimes on these retreats, sometimes even in a number of retreats when they begin, we're kind of working through this, preparing ourselves for the time when we can go into, you know, some different kinds of places in meditation. So anyway, so the Buddha then went into the woods, and I love this account. "On specially auspicious nights, I dwelt in such awe-inspiring, horrifying abodes as orchard shrines, woodland shrines, and tree shrines." Why they're so horrifying, I don't know. But, you know, there's spirits there. So maybe the spirits are dangerous there. And while I dwelt there, a wild animal would come up to me, or a peacock would knock off a branch, or the wind would rustle leaves. I thought, what now if this is fear and dread coming? I thought, why do I dwell always expecting fear and dread? What if I subdue that fear and dread by keeping the same posture that I am in when it comes upon me? So he has fear and dread coming up in these kinds of, in the woods at night. I remember I've gone camping by myself in the Sierras, and I was completely happy being completely alone, you know, no one for miles around off the trail and different places. And I felt comfortable until I got in my tent at night. And there was all these footsteps and crunching of leaves. And I mean, the monsters that come out at night in the Sierras, they must be huge. And like, what is that? What is that? And I sometimes would be awake for hours, like listening to all little branches snaps, just a peacock squawking around or something, you know, a little lizard or mouse or something. But so I know this well, that, you know. But then he just has the fortitude, the ability he's ready to face it and just be with it and not give into it and not be overwhelmed by it. It's kind of a remarkable event. The Buddha was afraid at one point. If some of you have fear while you're here, you have good company. I don't know if it's best company, but you should know that maybe it's helpful. Maybe it's, if you have fear, supportive to know, maybe, that when I signed up for my first retreat, I called up the week before and said, something important has come up, I can't come. They said, okay, we'll cancel you. What I didn't tell them, the important thing was that the important thing was fear. So I chickened out of my first retreat. So if you have some fear, you're in company, you have company. So what I like about this is that what the Buddha is pointing to, and this is why I read it, he's pointing to states of mind. He's pointing to our inner psychology and what's going on in there. That he's somehow understanding his life and what he can do and how he can do it. In very ordinary and modern world, we'd say psychological terms. There's no recourse to something beyond himself. There's no recourse to other teachers, no recourse to the supernatural or other kinds of things. He's just really, really delving deeply into his own psychology and finding out what's there and what doesn't support him and what does support him, what his capacities are. And this is not a coincidence. And now we come to a sutta where the Buddha talks explicitly about confidence. There's different words. This time the word is not sadha, but it's a word, asadi, that's sometimes translated as confidence. And the associations with this kind of confidence or this kind of faith is a clarity and a calmness. So this idea that faith is not a zealous faith, but rather a calm, clear, serene kind of faith. A serene, calm love. And so there's a list here of 17 things. And some of you just hearing, I'm going to do another list of 17 things is enough to begin, you know, like shutting off and, oh my God, not again, you know, and you're already ready to stop listening because you've done this before and you know how to tune out the teacher, you know, when they start doing these lists. And so I grant you that this can be boring, but this is actually supposed to be very exciting. I mean, if you knew the purpose for this and why I'm reading it to you, you would be at the edge of your seat. Like, this, now we're getting into something really important, because we are. And some of the language you'll even go, oh my God, these Buddhists, they're so negative. At least they are in English. What are the imperfections that defile the mind defile the mind. Oh. Yep, this negative view of things. But sometimes I translate it as soils the mind. Anyway, what bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetousness, and rough greed is an imperfection that soils the mind. Ill will is an imperfection that soils the mind. Anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and carelessness. All those are imperfections that soil the mind. So that's interesting. Maybe you have sometimes one or two of them here or there. And then he goes on, knowing that covetousness and rough greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, the practitioner abandons it. And the same thing with all the others. Abandons ill will, abandons anger, resentment, contempt, abandons insolence, envy, avarice, abandons deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, and abandons arrogance, vanity, and carelessness. But what's coming next is the most important part. This is where you should be on the edge. Be ready. You're on the edge of your seat. Sometimes you need to be helped to understand these texts, that why they're so exciting. When a practitioner has known that covetousness and rough greed is an imperfection that soils the mind and has abandoned it, when they have done this all of them, just knowing that all these things are suffering for the mind, all these things are challenging for the mind, are difficult for the mind, and impair the healthy working of the mind, and you learn to let go of it, that's a phenomenal thing. This is what's exciting about Dharma. This is really great. Because then we know a healthy mind. We know a mind that it's clear of all these agitations, all these things that contract it, that limit it, that soil it, that grab us by the throat or the nose or your ear, I don't know where they grab you, and pull you around and direct your thinking and sometimes your behavior and what you say. Sometimes there are some people who lose control of themselves when these things are strong. And they do and say things that it takes sometimes years to clean up and work through because of it. These are hugely challenging things. Just imagine if for one day everyone on this globe was free of these 17 things. For that day, newspapers would have gone out of business. Because most of what they write about has to do with one or more of these 17 things. I mean, imagine most of the problems we have on this globe of how people treat each other and affect each other come out of minds that have these operating. It would be phenomenal to walk through the cities and the towns and in the communities and feel like for that day, you don't have to be afraid of people because you're afraid of people who have these things. But without that, you wouldn't. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal for one person to have that, to walk through your own mind, to walk through your own heart and be freed of this. And experience that this is what a healthy heart is. This is what a healthy mind is. This is where there's peace. This is where there's clarity. This is quite something. This, now I can breathe easily. Now I can feel at ease that I've never felt before. Some people will say, now I can feel at home wherever I go without these. So the Buddha says that if a person has abandoned these, then they have a verified confidence, or this translation, he has unwavering confidence. The literal meaning for the adjective is based on knowing. So it's confidence based on knowing something. What do you know? You know the problematic mind states, and you, not only you know it's possible to have a mind without them, you've experienced it in such a clear, definitive way that it's been inspiring. Wow, this is possible? Wow, it's like you've been walking around with shoes, two numbers too small for you, and you think that's the way it is, and someone gives you shoes that fit you. Wow, this is, I never knew it was possible. What a difference. You know, it's a really amazing thing to experience this freedom like this, free of these things. With this confidence, with this verified knowing, unwavering confidence, one acquires unwavering confidence in the Buddha. The Buddha, enlightenment, is real. To the degree to have experienced this abandoning of these states, the Buddha certainly has done this, and probably much more. But now I can really know what the Buddha is about. Now I really have confidence. One acquires unwavering confidence in the Dharma, and I love this, when confidence the Dharma is well proclaimed, it's visible right here and now. Something you can see. It's not something far away or mystical or mysterious. It's immediately effective. It invites you to come and see it. Come and see. It's onward leading and experienced by the wise themselves. This here, knowing the imperfections of the mind and seeing the mind free of them, that they've been abandoned, that is what this is referring. This is what the Dharma is. The psychological movement of the mind that you witness, you know greed, you know the abandoning of it and the mind without it. That's visible here and now to the mind's eye. That's immediately effective. You know, wow, that was pretty cool. Wow, I feel much better. And there's an invitation, come here. There's a calling in that freedom. This is a good place to live. This is a good place to be. And the amazing thing is that in the middle, if you're really sensitive, in the middle of the tension and the pressure of greed, the contraction of greed, if you're really, you can feel that calling to freedom. Come here, let go. There's a place to let go here. It doesn't have to be this way. Come, you can do it. And to inviting inspection, onward leading, it leads to greater freedom. Once you begin this process of abandoning, letting go, experiencing these mind states that are free, that's onward leading. And then I love this idea, to be experienced by the wise themselves. So this means you. This is something you're supposed to experience yourself. And that's why we're here on this retreat, to create the optimal conditions to really have a deep experience for yourself. Of what? So first the unfortunate thing, I'm going to say, and then the fortunate thing. The unfortunate thing, or whatever, not popular thing, is to experience the times that it happens occasionally. Your greed, your hatred, your envy, your jealousy, your obstinacy, your conceit, your arrogance, your rivalry, and, you know, this wonderful list. So if it should happen accidentally that these happen on the retreat, good. Don't be upset. You're right on track. This is where you're going to see the Dharma that the Buddha is talking about. The Dharma is not mysterious. It's not mystical. It's not supernatural. It's right here in this life now that you can experience for yourself in this way. And then if you really are quiet, your mindfulness, your attention, your love, your inspiration, your faith helps you be really still and quiet to kind of feel and listen and hear, to receive, relax into with these challenges that you have, the distractions you have, the aversions you have, the desires you have, conceits you have. You'll come to a place in the middle of it all, maybe it's metaphoric middle, where you'll feel this call, let go, release, let it be, open up, soften. There's freedom here. There's a place where these things, all this is empty, gone. And so the thing to have confidence, so what happens at some point, the faith part of practice, the confidence part, the trusting, the fidelity part, the love part of it all, is to this possibility that we have for this kind of freedom that this text is talking about. It's a fidelity to kind of, I call it an ethical purity inside, a freedom inside. We trust the absence, we trust the freedom from these states more than we trust those states. And this is if you know, most people, if they took a good look at themselves and kind of, you know, did a statistical analysis or something like that of what the mind is about most of the time, they would probably have to admit, I think I trust greed. Something inside of me trusts ill will and aversion. Something trusts conceit, because that's mostly what my mind does. It's like thinking, doing this all the time. So, you know, of course, I don't trust those things. But, you know, maybe I'm not, but something inside there really does, because it keeps doing it over and over and over again. And so, yes, you don't say we have faith in those things, but it's the equivalent of something inside has a lot of faith in distractions and fantasy and wanting things to be different and holding on to things. And in order to do this practice, we want to begin having faith in something else. And that's where we have some choice. We have some we can orient ourselves to something. And at first, maybe it's just trusting the teachings you hear or the teachers you're with, that this is a possibility for you, that there's a different way, different states of mind, different way of orientation for the heart that you can come to. But the idea is that hopefully relatively quickly, you start getting little glimmers. Yeah, look at that. I spent all morning long angry at what someone said at work last week. But look at this. I came back after lunch and it's gone. And this feels so much better. Oh, something had a lot of faith in anger in the morning. But look at this. It's not here. And the absence of it, what do I do with it? Well, now I should just find something to want or find someone else to be angry with. Or let's trust this. It's not dramatic. I don't feel, you know, like this is not fireworks. It's not like Disneyland of spiritual experiences. But it's still, there's freedom of that anger. Wow. this is possible. And begin appreciating all the times throughout the day when you start tasting a little flavor. You're hungry for lunch and dinner or something, and you were thinking a lot about it, you really wanted it, and you stand in line like hoping the person in front of you wasn't going to take the last something. So you're kind of caught up in it, but then you sit down, you eat. For a few moments, you're satisfied. And you don't want any more food, you don't want anything else. For a few moments, appreciate that. There it is. What can you learn from the absence of having greed for food, if that's what it is? What is that like to be free of it? And so to have fidelity to this possibility, to have fidelity and inspiration and love for a practice of attention, that is being the host to your experience and telling all the guests, come. Come and relax. Come and settle. All these 17 things, ill will, conceit, avarice, greed, insolence, carelessness, all of these are activated states. They're not natural states. They're activated energetic states. Come here, come, my friend. It's okay. I'll see you. I'll be with you. I'll allow you. I'll feel the experience so that it can relax. Something inside of us, when there's all these states are there, something inside really needs to be reassured, relax. So the kind of faith of practice, the kind of practice where there's a love, there's a hospitality, there's kind of a goodness, a kind of commitment, fidelity to the absence of greed, the absence of ill will, towards the very things that are hard, to the various things which are the opposite of those. Bringing absence of greed to the greed that we have. Absence of ill will to our ill will. And having this kind of, I don't know if commitment is too big of a word, but I like the word fidelity, which kind of means being committed, being loyal to what? Ultimately, it's not to the Buddha, it's not to the Dharma, it's not to the Sangha, it's not to, but it's really to the Dharma that's in you. This freedom, this clarity, this openness, this absence of the 17 things, or sometimes reduced to 3, greed, hate, and delusion. Wow. Now, you don't get a lot of credit at office parties. You know, you've been on retreat, and what was that like, and what is this Buddhism about? Oh, it's about somehow overcoming my greed and ill will and conceit and deceit and carelessness. And you go through the 17, right? And you know, after a while, people at work, oh, I'm sorry for you. If that's what you're about, and I mean, I went on vacation, you know, and I went, you know, but I did these really exciting things and great altered states of consciousness, and you just had the absence of greed? Well, okay. So you don't get a lot of credit, but that's really good, because you don't want any credit for your spirituality. You don't want to make a conceit around it. You just want your freedom. And to have this loyalty, to have this commitment, this inspiration, this love, or the possibility of creating this great clean heart, clean mind, but nothing soils it. And what good does that do you? Then you can love. Then there's space in your heart for everyone, everything. And the love can just keep growing and growing, because there's more and more space in that heart for it all. And then maybe you'll come to appreciate that maybe sadha can mean love. And maybe there's a love for the practice, love for the effort we make, the energy. There's a lot. We can do that with love. We can do it. And mindfulness is an expression of love. It's not a duty. Samadhi is a consequence of love. And wisdom is the full fulfillment of love. Wouldn't that be nice? So in this way that we can personalize the Dharma, I'd like to call sadha love today. In the way that I cannot personalize it, but I have to have a certain, that the parts of the Dharma we have to kind of just accept. This thing about the letting go, the abandoning, the quieting, the settling, the absence of these things, these things that soil the mind, that's kind of unnegotiable if what you want is to, do this kind of thing. You can do something else, but for Buddhism, there's what you personalize and what you don't personalize. But luckily, there's 17 of them. And that way you can also find it, the person next to me is probably dealing with X, but I'm dealing with Y. That's how it's personal. My thing is insolence. Okay, well, that's what it is on this retreat. I guess that makes it personal. So anyway, there's the personal and that which is not personal in this Dharma practice. But to have this faith in the Dharma is to have faith in this deeply non-personal aspect of the Dharma, it has to do with this freedom from the attachments that grab us and hold us tight. It is possible. It can be done. It's worthwhile having confidence in it. And that sets the stage, sets the fuel, sets the momentum for a healthy form of energy, of effort, of engagement, which will be the topic for tomorrow. And in the meantime, you'll be well prepared if you spend the next hours loving, letting your practice be a love, form of love, or faith, or confidence, whichever is your thing. So thank you.